This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, landmines don't just kill and maim. In Colombia, they cause starvation.
There's lots of people that are still trapped in the middle of the mines. They can't move either left or right or up or down. There's a lot of people who are eating, as they say, water and salt.
Plus, high and dry in Ethiopia, a lake turns to land. And an ode to the Phoenix bicycle, the wheels of choice in southern Sudan.
A favorite decorative theme is the bouquet of pink, blue, and red fake flowers on the front handlebars. No basket, just flowers.
All that's ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The civil war in Colombia has dragged on for 40 years. The conflict between rebel groups and government forces makes life difficult for the civilian population, especially those living in rural areas. Take the story of Dagoberto Irowa. One morning in March, Dagoberto set out from his small village and headed to a neighboring town. He wanted to sell a mule. His family needed the money. Even so, they pleaded with him not to go. Just months before, rebels had littered the surrounding countryside with landmines. Conrad Fox reports from southern Colombia.
There have been landmines hidden in the fields and roads of this mountainous region for years. The crudely made but powerful devices are placed by the left-wing rebel group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN for its initials in Spanish. The group uses the mines to keep government forces at bay, and until recently, locals knew where most of them were planted. But a few months ago, the Colombian army began attacking the ELN. Desperate, the rebels planted ever more mines, most of them unmarked. Now, for locals, a simple trip like Dagoberto's, to sell a mule, has become all but impossible. His friend, Edgar Narváez, picks up the story.
He was due back around 5 in the afternoon, but he never turned up.
Algunos trabajadores habían escuchado eso de la una de la...
Some workers said that around 1 o'clock, they heard a mine explode.
La familia ya comenzó a angustiarse y me dice, usted
the family
tiene
begged me,
acompañarnos.
You've got to help us look for him.
Para mí era algo muy duro.
For me, that was hard.
Sumamente duro.
Really, really hard.
Yo sabía que estábamos arriesgando la vida.
I knew we were risking our lives.
Reluctantly, Narváez joined the family in retracing Dagoberto's steps. They drove 2 mules in front of them, hoping that if they crossed a mine, the animals would trip it before they did. After several hours walking through the forest, their fears were confirmed.
Miramos un galoncito de café que había llevado como...
We saw a thermos of coffee that Dagoberto had taken.
Alto por allá, unos 6 metros, alto en un árbol, encontramos una camisa. Estaba allí.
Way up in a tree, there was a shirt, as if someone had hung it there.
Una hija, Rosa, se metió sobre el bosque y pronto dijo, aquí está mi papá.
His daughter, Rosa, walked off in the woods. Here's my dad, she called out.
Estaba muerto. Muchas partes de su cuerpo ya no estaban.
He was dead. Lots of his body parts were just missing.
According to the Ottawa-based organization World Landmine Monitor, Colombia has the highest rate of mine-related accidents in the world. Last year, 193 people were killed by landmines in Colombia. In Nariño, the problem is now so severe, it has brought normal life to a standstill. Narváez says that in his community, many farmers are afraid to work their fields. In others, people are afraid to leave their houses.
The army was getting closer and closer, and the guerrillas were mining the road. That's when I started to get scared.
This man is a teacher at a rural school in the heart of ELN-controlled territory. He doesn't want his name used, or the name of his village, for fear of reprisals from the rebels. In January, when the army began closing in on the village, he and his neighbors were unable to leave, or to receive food from outside. For 3 weeks, they survived on nothing but rice and bananas. When even that ran out, they had no choice but to risk walking across the minefield to get food.
There were 30 of us, carrying our backpacks, a few clothes.
Todos mudos.
All of us quiet, 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 praying to God none of us stepped on a mine. I got to go at the back of the group.
After 4 hours, they reached a town outside the conflict zone. They were lucky, he says.
There's lots of people that are still trapped in the middle of the mines. They can't move either left or right or up or down. There's a lot of people who are eating, as they say, water and salt, and that's it.
According to municipal authorities, some 3,400 people in the conflict zone are unable to leave their communities or get food transported in. Information about the conditions in the communities is sketchy. There are no land telephone lines, and rebels forbid the use of cell phones within their territory. The best place for news is here, in the busy main square of Samaniego, a town outside the conflict zone. While locals chat in the open-air cafes and food stalls, a few campesinos from affected communities shop for supplies. Like the schoolteacher, most of them have walked out on back trails, where mines are less likely. This man, who won't give his name, says it took 2 days to walk from his village. He says that back home, there's not much left to eat.
Pues ahorita de los productos que se dan allá, como la yuca, el chiro, el maíz.
Just what we can grow there. Yucca, banana, corn, sugarcane. We used to be able to fish and hunt, but because the mines are everywhere, we can't even do that. Since the roads were closed, we can't feed our kids like they need to be. They're getting tired and malnourished and sick.
But tomorrow he's going back. He says the rebels have told him and his neighbors that if they don't return soon, their lands will be confiscated. 15 miles away in the village of El Decio, Major Javier León of the Colombian Army talks to a group of campesinos. They're from communities deep in the conflict zone. 2 days ago, the campesinos walked 8 hours on a back route to buy supplies in Samaniego. Now they're trying to get home on the main road. Thanks to demining, they've made it this far in a rented truck. The major says the road is clear for another mile or so from here, but beyond that, he gives no guarantees.
Dígale no a la coca y cultiven cositas que realmente ustedes puedan sacar con orgullo sin ningún problema, ¿okay?
Most of the campesinos, including Rubia Alvarez, are willing to risk the minefields to get back home. I feel okay about it, she says. I just thank God I'm going to be home and will be with my child soon. When the major finishes talking, the campesinos cram into the back of their truck. They drive up a tortuous mountain road towards home, but are stopped at numerous army checkpoints. At the last one, soldiers warn them they will have to cross on foot a small village deserted weeks ago by its inhabitants. The houses and streets here are booby-trapped with explosives. There's a grim silence as they get down from the truck. 5 minutes from here, they can see the village, where even the army is afraid to go. Word arrives from a local farmer that we are being watched by ELN fighters from a hideout less than half a mile away. Finally, one man calls out, "Let's go." "To everyone his own saint," says another. In single file, they head briskly down the road, avoiding my microphone. Talking to a journalist can be risky if the rebels find out. I try to ask a question of Rubia Alvarez. I can't talk now, she says frantically. Get the microphone away. Within a few minutes, the group snakes its way through the empty streets of the village, then rounds a bend and is out of sight, beyond the help of the army. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Nariño State, Colombia.
Conrad sent us this update. A few weeks ago, one person was killed and three were injured on the main route to Samaniego. Conrad said he had a few close calls, too, while covering this story. Journalists often find themselves in dangerous situations. Rob Crilly is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He told us about a special training session he attended in London on how to report from a war zone. The sessions are led by British Royal Marine Commandos.
The first thing they teach you is a huge amount of first aid, because people do get injured in these situations, and very often it's the first few minutes that can make the difference in saving someone's life. Obviously, the other thing they teach you is how to make sure that you're not a target. So it's keeping your eyes open for things out of the ordinary that might suggest something nasty is about to happen. So it's all sorts of things that you might encounter in a combat zone. And very often there are no easy answers to what you might do in these circumstances. But what these guys are trying to teach you is that, first of all, you should go in prepared, which is something the most journalists don't think about. They pick up their notebook and run.
Can you share with us any of the things about preparation that that you've learned that might not be so obvious? How would a journalist prepare other than, I mean, it's interesting that you say some journalists just go in taking their notepads. I would think they'd be a little more prepared in a war zone.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain things that you might do when traveling in a war zone. As a journalist, you might think it was sensible to go into an area wearing a flak jacket, body armor, for example. But in certain circumstances, it could actually make you a target. In Somalia, for example, it has been known for people just to walk up to a journalist wearing a flak jacket and test their AK-47. You know, is this really a bulletproof jacket? So there are lots of things that you might think are a good idea in a war zone, which could be counterproductive. For another example might be if you're reporting on right at the front line on fighting, you might take cover behind a wall, just perhaps sometimes looking around it to get an idea of what's going on. But of course, that is exactly what a sniper would be doing, tucked away in a corner, just peering around the corner. So under other circumstances, it might be better to dress in bright clothing and to stand right in the middle of things and make it obvious what you're doing.
Rob, did you ever imagine that you'd go into this kind of reporting when you got into journalism, or did you just kind of stumble into it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I had no intention of doing it whatsoever. I would much prefer to be sitting somewhere comfortable with a mug of cocoa, writing up my nice color pieces from a distance. But I had an interest in Africa, and before long I realized that within my patch were some pretty hot areas, and there was no way you can really cover the stories properly without going there. And sometimes, inevitably, whatever protection you might take, you can end up in the line of fire. So it's one of these things that I suppose I wandered into, and now I'm trying to make sure that I'm fully equipped to deal with it. It's always at the back of your mind, and I think we're all guilty, perhaps, of thinking we're invincible sometimes, that it's not going to happen to us. And, the courses like this are invaluable in teaching you that it can happen to you, but there are things that you can do to try and reduce the risks and maximize your chances of survival if that million to one bullet does hit you.
All right, Rob, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great, thanks very much.
Rob Crilly is a journalist with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from London. Coming up, a Chinese athlete who's the pride of her country, but she wasn't at the Olympics. We'll tell you why, just ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The Beijing Olympics ended a few weeks ago, but questions are still swirling about whether some Chinese gymnasts were underage. The team won the gold medal, but an investigation is underway. Meanwhile, there's no doubt that one Chinese favorite was too young to participate this time around. Zhang Huimin is a runner. Last year, she ran a full marathon in her home province of Hainan in just 3 hours and 43 minutes. That time would be impressive for any runner, but Huimin is only 8 years old. She has many fans in China, but critics say that her father is exploiting her and pushing the little girl too hard. Jennifer Dunn reports from Hainan Island.
It's 5:15 in the morning as little Zhang Huimin runs along a dark street beside her father. Near the end of their 10-mile run, Huimin's breath is still steady and strong. She sings the theme song from her favorite cartoon and occasionally checks in with me to ask if I'm tired yet. Don't worry, we just have a little bit left to go, the slight 8-year-old assures me before sprinting ahead. This morning's run is light training for Huimin. She usually runs up to 28 miles before school.
Anything under 15 miles, I can run with her. More than that, I can't keep up, so usually I ride my bike along beside her.
That's 54-year-old Zhang Jianmin, Huimin's father. He started training with his daughter when she was only three and says his ultimate goal is for her to compete in the 2016 Olympics. Huimin made headlines after completing Hainan Island's marathon last year. She became a media sensation after running 2,180 miles from Hainan to Beijing in only 54 days. Huimin says that journey was her idea. One day, I told my dad I wanted to run all the way to where the moon sets. He said that that would be impossible, but if I wanted to run to Beijing, that would already be incredible, she explains. There has been mixed public reaction to Huimin's story. On the one hand, people adore the young champion, but critics say that such intensive training is dangerous for a growing girl. Some go so far as to say Zhang is exploiting his daughter in the hopes of cashing in on her fame. Zhang is well accustomed to the criticism. We sit down to talk in his small one-room home in Lingao, one of the poorest regions on Hainan Island. Zhang used to operate a small fish farm, but now he trains his daughter full-time, and the family relies primarily on an older son's income. Before I even have the chance to ask, Zhang insists that it is Huimin's own passion for running, not pressure from him, that drives her to run.
At first I told her to slow down, but she always wanted to run farther and faster. So I said, if you can make this sacrifice, then I will too. Now we guide each other.
When I first spoke with Huimin, it was difficult to assess her enthusiasm. She is also accustomed to media interviews, and her responses seemed rehearsed. I love to run. Running to Beijing was wonderful, she says in a clipped, monotone voice. She is much more animated when she shows me her toys, a row of ragged stuffed animals she introduces by name.
These are my toy. It's called Hello Kitty Mama.
And this is my favorite toy, she says, delicately fingering a sparkly plastic princess crown. As her father acknowledges, Huimin doesn't have much time to play with her toys or with friends. But he's adamant that these long hours of daily training haven't damaged her body.
She has a full checkup before and right after every marathon, and the doctors are always impressed with her condition. In fact, her heart rate returns to normal much faster than most of the adults who run the marathon.
He says doctors have also determined that her bones are healthy, but that she is slightly undernourished. Zhang says he's trying to increase her protein intake, but the family's financial situation makes that difficult.
We can't afford to have meat at every meal, but I have recently dramatically increased milk and eggs in her diet. I used to train for marathons myself. I understand the dietary needs and physical limitations involved.
Before an upcoming marathon, father and daughter attend a press conference in Hainan's capital of Haikou. Because of Huimin's age, the marathon committee doesn't let her officially enroll in the race. But they do let her run the full distance with other competitors. Zhang gives a long and detailed talk about his daughter's successes and their plans for future marathons. Huimin bounces around the room, climbing into the laps of familiar reporters, rifling through conference bags for candy. Li Ping, the director of the marathon committee, announces, "We all love Huimin. We hope she will hurry up and grow up so she can officially run with us." But when I interview him after the press conference, his opinion is more complicated.
I love her running spirit, but whether or not this plan is going to work is unclear. We all think her training is far too intensive, and we have repeatedly warned Mr. Zhang to slow down. A child this age should just be running to play. Maybe even a few miles here and there, but not like this, not 25 miles every day.
Despite these warnings, Zhang shows no signs of easing up on Huimin's running regime. He insists that it will lead to a bright, successful future when defined by athletic fame rather than poverty. As for Huimin, she says she is happiest when running. During my interview with her, that claim seemed coached, but when running beside her, it was easy to believe. Look at me, I can fly, she shouts as she sprints into the growing morning light.
Yeah!
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jennifer Dunn on Hainan Island.
sports can mean more than medals and fancy uniforms, especially for one team in Utica, New York. One in six residents there is a refugee. They've come from more than 26 countries across Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. Most of the refugees fled their homes to escape persecution. And though they're happy to be here, adjusting to life in the city can be difficult. One man is trying to make Utica feel more like home for some young African and Asian refugees. Amy Bracken reports.
Utica is a dilapidated city on the Erie Canal. Many refugees new to the area are afraid of their gang-infested neighborhoods and schools, not to mention the harsh winters and alien language and culture. There is, however, one place in Utica where some refugee kids feel very much at home. Ready, go! It's a gray Sunday morning on the edge of the city. Dozens of Somali and Burmese boys have turned out for practice on a soccer field. The guy who's doing the yelling here is a pink-faced 47-year-old man in a sweatsuit. Mike Caperta is a longtime coach for expensive soccer club teams for suburban kids. Now he holds a weekly practice for refugee kids living in the heart of the city. When transportation is available, Caperta says as many as 60 of them turn out.
They found out about me through a flyer or word of mouth, and really the only word they had to hear was soccer. And that was enough to inspire them. That was enough to allow them to feel that they're home, even though they're halfway around the world.
For the refugee players, the sport is often the only diversion in a bleak life. 21-year-old Somali, Abdi Ibrahim, moved here a year ago. He'd spent most of his life in refugee camps in Kenya. Even when they were underfed and thirsty, Ibrahim says he and his friends in the camps rallied for their favorite game.
Oh, we did. We still had energy to play soccer because that's how we're going to forget about the things that happened to us. If you stay in the house, you're going to think a lot, you're hungry, you don't have anything to eat.
Like Ibrahim, Caperta sees sports as a way of coping with hardship. It's something he knows about firsthand.
I lost my father in an extremely untimely death when I was 14 years old. And then I became the angry young man, you know, that gosh, why me, why me? But sports is what saved my butt because there was that structure. There was that need to be someplace at some time rather than no place going nowhere. And I didn't have the added challenge of being halfway around the world. I didn't have the added challenge of growing up in a terrible neighborhood. You know, so I looked at the refugees, and as I'm gaining, you know, years on my life, I got to find ways to give back.
And parents of local kids on Caperta's elite teams agree.
Anybody need shorts? We got a lot of shorts here.
Some bring donated clothing, equipment, and refreshments to the refugee practice. These weekly refugee practices are also an opportunity for Caperta to recruit the best players onto his competitive club teams. Membership to one of them normally costs about $3,000 per year. But Caperta covers all costs for refugee kids.
You guys just, you can get his name, address, and then if there's a phone number or email.
After practice, with the help of a volunteer translator, Caperta works out the logistics of recruiting 14-year-old Yo-Yo, who's from Burma. Caperta says part of helping the kids is getting to know them.
I love helping the kids, you know, and it's funny that you actually were here today when we discovered somebody, Yo-Yo. and I'm going to have the pleasure of learning about Yo-Yo's life over the next month. You know, one of these days it'll be my turn to drive him home. And I'll, you know, end up meeting mom and dad, or I'll see the environment, whatever the challenges the young man has.
In fact, Caperta will never meet Yo's parents. Yo says both his parents died when he was young. His mother died of an illness and his father at the hands of a Burmese soldier. He now lives in Utica with his older brother and uncle. Caperta says he has great admiration for immigrants and refugees and loves to see people overcome adversity.
Everybody's got heartache. Everybody's got heartache. But how we respond to that, that's what matters. And if a kid comes to me and he's got challenges, I'll do what I can to help him. Okay, look at each other. Realize right now that you're teammates. Anybody can be a great teammate when you're winning. This is a chance to define yourself.
With more and more Burmese families arriving in Utica, Caperta's recruiting project could become very expensive. He is seeking corporate funding, saying no young refugee should be deprived of the chance to play soccer. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amy Bracken in Utica, New York.
Are you going to be able to come back? Are you going to be able to play great defense?
Scott Neeson was a high-flying Hollywood insider. He headed up international marketing for 20th Century Fox, and he hung out with people most of us only see on the screen. Then he took a trip to Asia. It was a vacation, a chance to relax and recharge, have some fun. But a tour through the massive garbage dumps of Phnom Penh and Cambodia changed all that.
I was taken down there by a local, and it was just quite mind-blowing. Just this vast 11-acre site of garbage, and there's children everywhere. They live in the garbage dump, and they work every day picking through recyclables. And it is shocking. It's as close to an apocalypse as I'd ever want to see.
So what did you do?
At that moment, I took two children out of the dump. I found their parents, talked to them, and those two children started in school. And the lesson there, and I think it was an important lesson for me, was that such a small, small part of my income changed these children's lives profoundly.
And then you had to go back to this big new job you had taken on with Sony Pictures, back to LA. What a contrast.
It was, actually. And when I got back, I just couldn't get it out of my mind. Not only the visual and the olfactory of the garbage dump, but also how excessive the life was that I was leading.
What was your life like in Hollywood? Can you draw us a picture of that?
I was single, had a very nice house, had a Porsche, very nice yacht in the marina. And then there was the premieres, the Academy Awards, and lots of international travel.
A lot of people's dream life.
Yes, and that was one of the issues, actually. When you're surrounded by people who are telling you what a wonderful life you have, you are so lucky, and you have hundreds of people wanting that job that you have, you do believe it, and it takes a lot to be able to break out of that.
So what did you do? Let's get back on that track. You got back into that Hollywood life you were in, and you couldn't forget about what you'd seen in Phnom Penh.
Yes. Well, before I left Phnom Penh, I had a bigger plan, and it was quite simple, to bring children out of the dump and put them into school. That I was 44, 45, and I'd been in the business 25 years, so I made a commitment to myself. I would stick out this job for 1 year and see how I felt. If I still had the same passion to help and to serve the children, then I would move there. And within that 12-month period, I'd gone back to Cambodia every month for periods between 2 days and 7 days.
Every month?
Yeah, it's quite a trip too.
Why did you go back every month? What were you doing?
Each time I went back there was another step forward, and each step was exponentially bigger, bringing in the number of children, setting up an education program. And I think the biggest step forward was when I took a lease on a building, and that's where there was a tangible point where the Cambodian Children's Fund first started.
So you were going back and forth every month, and then something happened in your work that kind of flipped the switch for you. What happened?
I was in Phnom Penh, and I was there. I had 11 or so children who had started at CCF, and there was typhoid amongst at least 5 or 6 of them. And it was something I had no idea how to deal with, what the resources were, and I hadn't had children of my own, so it was quite a dramatic experience. And during this, I had a phone call from a very major star and the star's agent. They were quite infuriated because their private jet didn't have the amenities they wanted on board, and the star was refusing to get on the private jet, which was costing a massive amount of money.
Why did they call you in Cambodia?
I was then head of marketing, and that covers the publicity with the actors, and this actor was high enough up and meaningful enough to warrant going straight to me. And I couldn't imagine two more extremes. These children from the garbage dump who were suffering typhoid, and an actor who would not get on a private jet because, you know, his amenities weren't there. And it's hard to ignore that sign, a sign that I needed to change, and this was as obvious as it could get.
You just, right there that day after that call, made a decision to switch completely and move to Cambodia?
Yes, I resigned from my job. It was exactly 12 months to the day. And in December of 2004, I moved to Phnom Penh. I've been living there now for nearly 3 years, and it's a very difficult life.
What makes it difficult?
There is an awful lot of suffering there. It's a country that's still recovering from many, many years of civil war, that's recovering from the Holocaust of Pol Pot, when one third or so of the population was wiped out. And there's a large percentage of child prostitution. There's a very high domestic abuse rate. And there's a general cultural acceptance to it, which I had trouble coping with initially.
Mm-hmm. And what is your organization doing now, Scott, on the ground to work against that?
We now have 270 children, of which about 180 are from the garbage dump. I would immodestly say it's the highest quality program, I think, of any non-profit in Cambodia. We offer private school level education in both Cambodian reading and writing. The core subjects are computer and English, which starts to fold into a vocational program. We also have health facilities in all of the residential areas, and we have a general support group. These children have it inside them. They just need an opportunity.
What is it like for you living there, knowing there are all these kids still on the dump, and you can only take out one at a time, maybe two at a time, and there's still so much need?
Even though we're at capacity and we cannot take more children in, I still like to be at the dump to take care of the children that are there and their parents and do what I can. I think probably one of the most touching moments was down the garbage dump and all the horror and all the misery. And I squatted down for a few minutes, and this young boy, who was about 7, had been picking through garbage. He came walking up and he sat down on my leg, put his arm around me, sighed, and just sat there for 3 or 4 minutes while he rested. And without a word, he got up and started working again. And really, it literally moved me to tears, and I didn't do that very often.
Mm. Looking back at what a dramatic shift and change your life took from just taking a vacation to Cambodia, how would you describe your life now?
Well, that's a really good question. People have an assumption that it's a happier life, and people say you must sleep well at night, and that's really not true. You do see an enormous amount of despair and just general tragedy. But the part of me that was empty, that was hollow, is now very full. And I work harder than I've ever worked. I no longer get a salary. But the peace that's now filled changes everything.
All right, Scott Neeson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scott Neeson is the founder and executive director of the Cambodian Children's Fund. He spoke to us from Los Angeles. Coming up, can greed save Africa? That question and an answer ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. Welcome back. Chala Ahmed had a dream. He wanted to build a waterfront home for his family on the shores of Lake Haramaya in eastern Ethiopia. But now that's impossible. The lake has dried up. Lakes all around the world are shrinking. Some attribute this to climate change. Others believe water mismanagement is at the root of the problem. Whatever the cause, the shrinking water supply is crippling communities across the globe. Jessica Partnow brings us this story from Ethiopia.
Chala Ahmed should be standing under 25 feet of water. Instead, he's in the middle of a pale, grassy field.
I came out in here at night. In the morning, I just wake up the first time. Then I went outside and see, and then I start crying,
Young children are herding sheep and goats around him as he shades his eyes from the afternoon sun. Ahmed had a dream to build a lakefront home for his family here. The 26-year-old has been working in Minnesota, driving a long-haul truck and saving up to build the house. This is his first visit home in 8 years.
Even right now, for me, when I walk on this lake, I get emotion, when I remember every little thing I used to do in this lake,
Friends had told him the lake was drying up, but it was hard to believe that a 9-mile stretch of water that had been there all his life could disappear.
It's sad. It's very sad. I never thought this lake was going to be gone because it was a natural thing,
For Ahmed, the water's disappearance came as a sudden shock. But for people living around Lake Haramaya, as it shrank, it was a horrifying decades-long process. Lake Haramaya is a closed water catchment fed only by rainfall, and the amount of water taken out simply overwhelmed the amount going in. Here, farmers frantically dig deeper and deeper into the mud in search of water for their crops. There's still water under the ground here, and in the rainy season, a puddle sometimes forms in the center of the lake. But right now, still months away from rain, the farmers must dig up to 22 feet into the earth before they hit water. Ahmed Dawid's family has been farming the land around Lake Haramaya for generations.
We spend a week digging a well like this one. Then we can go work on our farms for 2 or 3 days.
Like Dawid, many farmers here grow chaat, a mild stimulant popular in the region. Over the past decade, farmers have used irrigation to push the thirsty, deep-rooted shrub to produce 3 or 4 harvests a year. In the dry season, a single kilo can bring 1,000 Ethiopian birr, or more than $100, 10 times the rainy season rate. Dawid says the economic incentive to irrigate is intense.
Now we put all our energy into digging for water. We don't have enough time to tend our crops. We can't grow as much as we used to.
Dawid can see the water he's pumping from the lake bed won't last long. He's sending his 4 children to school in hopes they'll find work other than farming. He laughs when I ask him what will happen when the water goes.
What can we do? We have to follow the will of God.
Farmers have been blamed for what happened to the lake, but others share in the responsibility. A brewery used lake water to make beer, and the city of Harar used Haramaya as its primary source of drinking water. Climate change has only made things worse. The past 2 decades have seen rising temperatures, which lead to more evaporation and increasingly erratic rains.
You know the level of the water.
Okay, it's like a big yardstick that goes up to the top.
This is simply indication of how much it is inside. Mm-hmm. So we do have 3.
Bushara Rashid is head of public relations for the Harar Water Supply. We're looking at the city's 20,000-gallon reservoir, a squat cylindrical tank sitting in the hollow of land that used to be the lake's northern curve. The water comes from boreholes dug into the former lake bed, powered uphill by a humming generator. The system was constructed once it became clear that the lake was going to dry up completely, but it wasn't finished in time.
During the emergency, no school. School was closed. Even there is no water for hand washing.
The emergency started on February 10, 2004, when the pumps bringing lake water to the city of Harar were turned off for the last time. International aid groups sent in water trucks to help the 91,000 who were left without running water. Before the crisis, Rashid had lobbied the government to restrict lake water usage, but the regional and national water ministries each claimed the other was responsible.
So during that emergency period, we voiced or screamed that please declare a state of emergency.
The town eventually connected its 100-year-old pipes to the hastily dug boreholes, bringing water back to the city. Hydrologists have warned this groundwater will only last a few years. So next year, the town of Harar hopes to bring a new system online, which will pump groundwater from 30 miles away. It's estimated that water source will last 3 decades at the most. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow in Haramaya, Ethiopia.
Funding for this story was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Matt Strang is an aid worker with Mercy Corps in southern Sudan. The area is experiencing something of a rebirth since Africa's longest-running civil war ended there 3 years ago. About 15 million people who fled the region are steadily streaming back and rebuilding their lives. In this aid worker diary, Matt tells us about one particular item that's helping that effort.
I've probably seen thousands of bicycles in southern Sudan, and they all have one thing in common. They're all the same Chinese brand, the Phoenix, or Phonix, as locals pronounce it. Most are black, some are dark green or light blue, and all have the same gaudy red and gold-laced phoenix bird painted on them. It's fitting that this bike is named after the mythical bird that never dies, since southern Sudan is coming out of a long, violent nightmare and experiencing a rebirth of its own. The phoenix is so ubiquitous here that a friend wouldn't ask if he can borrow a bike to, say, go to the health clinic. He'd ask if he can borrow his friend's phoenix. Or, after purchasing a live goat to take home for dinner, you might hear, I'll just tie it to the back of my phoenix. Yep, I've seen a live goat strapped to the back of a phoenix, grunting after every pothole along the way. People here also go to great lengths to customize their phoenix. Maybe it's simply a practical solution to distinguish your phoenix from the hundreds of others parked outside the stadium during a soccer match. A favorite decorative theme is the bouquet of pink, blue, and red fake flowers on the front handlebars. No basket, just flowers. Another favorite decoration is the colorful green, red, and blue cushions, complete with gold tassels swaying back and forth to the rhythm of pedaling. These cushions have replaced the rack over the rear tire to allow the Phoenix to double as taxi. Male passengers usually straddle the cushion, legs dangling precariously close to the whirring spokes. Women sit side saddle, very elegant and demure, as a result of superhuman balance that can only come from years of practice. Most passengers, no matter what their gender, hang on for dear life. One day, a colleague and I took out 2 Phoenix for a spin around town. People along the road weren't sure how to react, since foreigners here drive around in white SUVs with aid group logos on the side doors. They seldom ride bikes. Some people laughed and pointed at us. Small children disappeared into the protective fold of their mother's vibrant dresses. One older man nearly rode his own bike off the steep shoulder of the road. Personally, I think NGOs should consider going with the Phoenix. It's cheaper, saves on fuel, and once decorated, it's much more stylish than the SUV.
Matt Strang is an aid worker with Mercy Corps in Southern Sudan. You can see photographs of the Phoenix bicycles and of Southern Sudan at our website, worldvisionreport.org. It's a tough question, and it's one that's asked frequently in the aid community. What's the best way to lift Africa out of poverty? Is it foreign aid or is it trade? Will microlending really make a difference? Journalist Robin Farzad came up with another idea when he reported on a small number of businessmen investing in profit-making schemes in Africa. Could greed save Africa? We invited him onto the show to answer that question. Robin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The title of the story you wrote for Business Week is Can Greed Save Africa? That's a pretty provocative title.
Right. We did really throw down a provocative gauntlet on the cover because it's hard enough to get anybody in the States to read a piece about Africa and the vagaries of development economics there. And the instant you read the story, you realize we're not extolling greed outright as much as a way of getting money to Africa through business thinking.
So let's talk about what we are extolling here. You got engineers, CEOs, and business entrepreneurs from Western countries going to some really desolate places in Africa to start businesses. Where is the money to be made there?
Let's be honest here. Sub-Saharan Africa is really the epicenter of poverty and misery. You talk about AIDS, you talk about all the things that Bono and Bill Clinton and the philanthropists have been telling us here. But to step back for a minute, I'm a business journalist, and I know that very successful investors are often the contrarian people, the ones who don't read all the disclaimery boilerplate about the place and pay attention to the stereotypes. And they actually go in and try to find real opportunities. They try to get maximum bang for their buck. And if they can actually end up improving the lot of people there and end up reversing some of these terrible statistics we see in terms of malaria incidents, the dire poverty that we see there, well, then everybody's the better for it.
Give us examples, if you will, of what kind of businesses are flourishing there.
Look, we have oil at $100 a barrel. We know that the supply is finite. There's a huge biofuel craze happening the world over, and investors are looking for sources of biofuel. So I cross paths with these investors out of London, Iranians who have seen Africa through the lens of diamonds and other businesses and logistics and shipping, and they realize that the it crop of Eastern Africa right now is Jatropha. It's an oil seed that grows in really wretched conditions in malarial bushes where there's only switchgrass and wastelands, and it just grows like it literally grows like a weed. And Africa has a lot of land, especially in a place like Mozambique, where they decided they could buy 200,000 acres of land. I mean, how often is something like that available on the cheap and have such an appreciative workforce, people who haven't worked for 30 years? And these guys realize that not only does the rest of Africa need biodiesel desperately, but if we have any excess production, we can ship it off to the rest of the world. I mean, Mozambique is on the Indian Ocean. We could get this to India. We can get it to China. I mean, this is the type of place where it absolutely logistically makes sense for us to do this.
Jatropha. What do you do with this?
Well, what it has is this fruit. And when you crack the fruit open, there's a massive black seed in it. And once it's pressed, the oil really lends itself to biofuel production. And I saw that in the first person. Literally every country I visited in Africa, I mean, I'm talking 7 or 8 countries, had a really cruddy power grid, and people were inordinately dependent on diesel generators. And people there need biofuel.
And who's making the money off of this?
Well, it's one example of really an incredible nexus of venture capital, because these guys are venture capitalists. They realize that there's a bit of a kind of a guessing in this. I'm putting the money forward. I'm fronting it. But the project may or may not work out, right? The government might experience a coup. They might expropriate this land. But I'm putting the money forward because the cost of entry is so low. One swath of malaria-infested Mozambique bush that had nil employment for the past 30 years. Suddenly, 620 people are employed. They're very eager to get to work. Some of them walk 5 to 10 miles a day. They're earning money. They're voting for the first time in their lives because this company, these venture capitalists, have given them a government pension. And a government pension gets you a government ID card. It was really striking to see in the first person. There's malaria eradication. And, you know, the on-site manager was a South African gentleman who actually fought in Mozambique back when the two countries weren't friendly, said that, look, I'd be the last person on the planet to go down as a philanthropist, but you cannot run a business when your workers are out sick with malaria or drinking dirty water. And that, more than any other quote in my story, resounded because it shows you how business interests really intersect with human interest.
Historically, outside foreign companies have come in and extracted resources from Africa and just left the country with nothing. But these businesses are different, you say. How exactly are they different?
You know, we're talking about financial sponsors, the likes of firms on Wall Street, insurers who want to diversify their investment base, private equity firms.
Are they less greedy than gold miners?
No, they're. I'm going to take a term that I learned at Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs had a term where it extolled its partners to think long-term greedy. And I saw that in this case because...
long-term greedy.
I know it sounds euphemistic.
No, it's not. I think I hear what you're saying. Long-term greedy means it's in our best interest to take care of the
people. No, not even that. I mean, if you exploit something, it's going to come back and bite you in the tail. The people are going to resent you. The government is going to come back and say, what the heck are you doing to my people? I'm going to tax you to death. I mean, it sows the seeds of its own demise. That's in no one. No investor wants to go through the trouble of opening up the opportunity, investing in it, hiring all the other people, and then, you know, in the fifth year of operation, deciding to go for an abusive motif.
Well, plenty of investors have done exactly that in the past.
When these investors opened up their books to me and explained their plans, what they're looking to get out of these businesses, many of the time horizons were 10 to 15 years. People saying by the 10th year in that Mozambique biofuel farm, you know, we're hoping to buy another 500,000 acres. We'll be shipping it to these countries. I'm not so impressed that the more mercenary elements who are coming into Africa for the past 150 years said, well, we're going to do this for 20 years and then cut and run. It's kind of a whack-a-mole strategy. Just kind of go in, get it, and get out before things get too hot. And don't get me wrong. There's still plenty of that going on in Africa. But never before have you seen really Wall Street and institutional investors go in with a longer-term horizon.
There is so much debate in the Western world about the best way to pull Africa out of desperate poverty. Some experts say we need to pour money and aid into the country. Others say pouring the aid in doesn't make any difference. How do you think, as a journalist watching and investigating this, that these investors fit into the aid debate?
I think investors, and by the way, I think both elements are very necessary. You need kind of jiggers of both, especially when we talk about health and nutrition and infant mortality. There's only so much the... private investors can do immediately. But having said that, aid doesn't have its own self-perpetuating mechanism. Aid is dependent on congressional authorization, depends on the type of people we have in the White House, depends on the need. But private investment is the ultimate self-perpetuating mechanism. I mean, the instant other people find out that this fertilizer is selling like hotcakes or this biodiesel or the microloan business, everybody else tries to pile in. The country is suddenly developed. It's going to move on to the next element of investment. And I don't think aid does that.
Robin Farzad, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Robin Farzad is a writer for Business Week magazine. We spoke with him from New York City. Floods have killed more than 1,000 people in South Asia since the monsoon season began in June. Millions more have been displaced. Reporter Peter Aronson lives in Mumbai. He sent us this reporter's notebook about his experience with the monsoon rains.
My wife and I were only gone one night, I swear. Yet it was enough time for the annual Indian monsoon to descend on Mumbai and burst into our home. We came in to find our cat cowering in fear under the dining room table, her fur standing on end. As I entered the bedroom, my foot plopped into a puddle. When we left the day before, we hadn't realized the monsoon was on its way. Carelessly, we left one of the bedroom windows open before heading across town, and the rain found its way into our apartment. Since we live on the 19th floor, we're far removed from the dangers of flooding. Not so the rest of the city. The most vulnerable are the families living in tin shacks or under tarps in the streets. Slum dwellers make up some 40% of Mumbai's population. If their lean-tos happen to be next to or over a drain, they can be easily washed away. It's almost like a Hurricane Katrina for some families, year in and year out. Even the well-off aren't immune from the monsoon's effects. One wealthy lady I know told me she'd had to move into her living room because of what she called the seepage problems in her bedrooms. But it's like that every year, she told me. Every year? I asked her. How many years have you had seepage problems? Only for the past 17. So, like anything that's an annual event and lasts 3 months, people get used to it. After all, they still have to work and go on with their lives. So they stand nonchalantly at bus stops or cross the street, up to their knees in water. I once saw a taxi driver stick his arm out the car window and proceed to squeegee his windshield with a detached wiper blade, all while keeping his car on the road. The monsoon actually offers diversions, too. Mumbai is on the Arabian Sea, and families crowd onto the boardwalk to enjoy the sight of giant waves crashing over onto the street. Sometimes poor kids grab inner tubes or anything that will float and turn the flooded streets into their own filthy brown swimming pool. As powerful as the monsoon may be, the people here in Mumbai know it is, after all, just another season.
Peter Aronson is a freelance journalist based in India. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can find out more about the program at our website, worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.